Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. So, Longpa and Ajahn Kurnadamo have gone down to the Bay Area for an appointment, the Tibetan doctor. Be back tomorrow afternoon at some point. Been in retreat for 21 days now, 3 weeks. At this point, people settling into retreat. If you're not experiencing unending bliss and rapture, then I don't know what's wrong with you. If you're in the majority, then there might be difficulties, and there might be questions. Those who are experiencing unending bliss and rapture are usually in the minority. So, might be a good time for practical tips, tricks, guidelines for being in retreat. I've noticed a number of people here right now are vegetarian, so that's something that could be talked about. It's a praiseworthy practice, but also keeping in mind that we have one main meal a day, so especially when you're vegetarian or even more extreme vegan, then it's good to be careful with our digestive system and know how to do that practice, how to take on that practice in a way that's sustainable, so we aren't just getting thinner and thinner and the mind tends to get a bit tight if we don't get enough nourishment. So eating one meal a day, there's lots of practical considerations and how to actually do this practice in a way that's sustainable. We also have a number of precepts and practices that we follow here, which if we're not careful, we can get a bit contracted, tight. When I was in Thailand, living at Wat Nong Bapong, one day Lungpa Liam gave a really nice ovada about just practical considerations around eating the meal. I found it extremely helpful, so thought I'd pass on some of that. One is the digestive system is quite delicate, so it's finding ways to be easy on it. A lot of the time, eating more doesn't necessarily give us more energy. So we take this teaching stemming from Venerable Sariputta of taking the meal, eating enough until we feel that it'll be 4 or 5 mouthfuls until we're completely full. And then instead of eating those 4 or 5 mouthfuls, then we take water or whatever drink we happen to have taken that day. We drink that, so it could be half a cup or a cup of liquid, and then we'll feel full. That's usually a good practical guideline for not overstuffing ourselves, because if we eat too much, then the stomach has a hard time digesting all of that food. Not all of it will get properly digested and absorbed into the body. So we might find that sometimes if we're having a bit of trouble with digestion or a lot of drowsiness in the afternoon, then we might find that eating a little bit less, we actually get less hungry, have more energy. The body has absorbed more of the nutrients than it would if we actually ate more. So we have to find the right amount, what is good for eating. A guideline that Lungpa Liam also was quite emphatic about was with liquids. So being careful with liquids, not drinking any liquids an hour before or an hour after the meal. If we drink liquids before, then we're diluting all of our digestive juices, and that makes the food very, very hard to digest. And so it's like taking it easier on our stomach, you know, giving our, it's quite delicate. It's a, you know, the digestive juices, allowing them to do their work. And then also after the meal, if we like to have tea or coffee after the meal, ideally waiting an hour, but you know, half an hour is also better than just, you know, gulping down a bunch of tea or coffee right away as soon as possible after the meal. So it's giving a bit of time for those digestive juices to do some of their work and break the foods down. We'll find that the nutrients absorb a lot better into the body. It's really important to be mindful of these practices, because we do eat one meal a day. If we find we get in the afternoon, sometimes we might get thirsty or hungry in the afternoon. It's good to have a jug of water in the dwelling place in the kuti, and one gets thirsty during the practice sessions in the afternoon. Take a cup of water, not more than that. If we find we're still thirsty, chances are we have a bit of a salt deficiency, especially if we're vegetarian, and even more especially if we're veering on the austere side of things and taking only very plain foods that don't have much salt in them, then we might have a bit of a salt deficiency happening. So it's very common for bhikkhus to have a little vial of salt that they keep with them. It's a lifetime allowable, so we can keep it as long as we want. The way to do it is to, so if we drink a cup of water in the afternoon, we're still thirsty, chances are we have a bit of a salt deficiency, so it'd be good, rather than drinking more and more water, that's actually not going to take the thirst away. Our body with a salt deficiency is having a hard time retaining moisture and water. So each afternoon, the way to do it is you take your vial of salt, you put a little bit of salt, a pinch of salt in the palm of one's hand, and then stick it on the tip of your tongue, and then keeping it in the center of the tongue, take it down into the throat. If the salt touches the sides of the tongue, it'll trigger our gag reflex, and we don't want that to happen, so keep it in the center of the tongue, take it to the throat, then take 2 to 3 gulps of water until there's not a salty taste in the mouth anymore. Also, for being vegetarian, it's quite good not to refrain from the breakfast. It's quite austere if you refrain from the breakfast plus be vegetarian. So, and also, if you think you might have a bit of a salt deficiency, try sprinkling some salt on the oatmeal in the morning. It's incredibly helpful. You might be surprised at how big a difference it can make in your experience of the day and the lessening of any discomfort that might happen in the afternoon. And especially with being vegan, again, a praiseworthy practice, but if one is, say, for example, eating a lot of things that are hard to digest, like nuts, you know, being careful with being selective, being careful, knowing how to get enough nourishment, enough nutrients. Because the one meal a day practice is difficult. It takes some getting used to. You know, taking plenty of fruits. If one is vegan, fruit is quite good. Avocado, getting your fat in that way. So we've been listening to a lot of teachings around mindfulness, satipatthana. It's good to start to integrate these things into our practice in a practical way, rather than keeping it up in the head. So if we have habits that we want to change, a lot of the practice is changing unwholesome habits and developing wholesome habits. This is the right effort that teachings, Lungpa and Ajahn Kurnadamo have been talking about, the teachings they've been presenting, right effort and right mindfulness, also right view, circling and revolving around all the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, especially highlighting those connections between right mindfulness and right effort, how those go hand in hand, reinforce one another, can't really be separated out. Because then when we're actually practicing, we're actually meditating. Then it's a point of actually doing it. Can be a difficult wall to get over, to shift ourselves from thinking about the teachings to a place of actually practicing them, actually applying them. So I'm thinking, like, yesterday a few of us went up to the Lungpo Cha Chedi site and did some meditation up there. I found it really enjoyable. And so it was a beautiful day. It was getting outside, meditating in nature. It's highly recommended. This is a practice that the Buddha praised. And these days, the weather's been incredibly beautiful, so highly recommended to go outside, sit at the foot of a tree, go for a walk, do some walking meditation outside, listen to the teachings in the mornings, and we have the Saturday nights in Wanpras, and that's enough, so... If we find that the mind is getting tight or we're experiencing some sort of dissatisfaction, tightness, just get outside, go for a walk, sit outside, take it easy on oneself, loosen up a bit, and the problem here is the mind is all tied up in knots. So just going outside, forgetting oneself for a little while, looking at the sky, looking at the birds, going and sitting somewhere outside, but taking these in the corner there, there's a cabinet in the corner there, and if one takes all the zafus out of the bottom partition, there's a sort of a secret little door, and under that secret little door there's these blue sitting mats, and those are specifically for sitting outside. So take one of those blue sitting mats and go sit outside somewhere. And it's a really wonderful practice. You see these pictures of Kruba Ajahns, and almost always, I mean, definitely these two pictures here, Lungpo Man, Lungpo Cha, they're sitting outside, and you almost never see a picture of these Ajahns sitting inside. It's very, very rare. Even someone like Ajahn Buddhadasa, I think I've only seen one or two pictures ever of him actually sitting inside somewhere. It's always sitting outside. You'll find sometimes sitting outside, it's a different experience than being in the kuti. You might find, like, you'll go to sit somewhere and there might be some insects or animals around. Like, there might be deer and they might be scared off temporarily when you go to sit down. But then after you sit for 30, 45 minutes or an hour, the forest sort of forgets about you, forgets you're there. And then animals start to creep up towards you, and a deer might come and start to graze next to you, or you might have a salamander crawl up on your leg, or, you know, a spider starts to spin a web sort of between your arm and your body. You know, this is wonderful experiences you can have sitting outside, and you get a sense of patience and just kind of melting into the forest, emerging into the forest. There's this phrase that's quoted so often in the forest ajans, like, it's praising sitting outside, that the Buddha was born in the forest, got enlightened in the forest, and died in the forest. He was born outside, he got enlightened outside, sitting at the foot of a tree. He passed away outside, sitting on his robe, laying down on his right-hand side on his robe, folded in four, at the root of two sal trees. It's quite a lovely image. The Buddha didn't die, like, hooked up to life support equipment in some hospital somewhere. You know, he passed away in the forest. It's quite a lovely image. Or even someone like, more recent times, like Ajahn Tongrat, he passed away. He just is just a very lovely setting. It's one of Ajahn Chah's main teachers, Ajahn Tongrat. It's evening time. They're all sitting outside. Everybody's sitting around, and Ajahn Tongrat would give a talk, kind of like our Saturday night talk, but it would be outside, and his students sitting around, you know, monks, disciples, you know, sitting around, and he would be sitting on a stone or a high seat giving a talk. So he just, it's just lovely, get this idea of this lovely setting. It's evening time, the crickets are singing, and he gives a talk as he normally would. Then he ends his talk by saying, "Okay, well, I bid you all farewell, and it's time to go now." So he lays down on his right side and just passes away right there in front of everybody. So Ajahn Tongrat, just like the Buddha, passed away outside at the foot of a tree. So I remember having some good experiences sitting outside at Daodam. I went out to Daodam, the chant, when I went out there in early 2006, it was me and just a few other monks got sent out there early before the large group of Wat Nanachat monks would go out there to spend the hot season. So I ended up going out with a few other monks about a month early. And there's a couple of different areas at Daodam. There's a kind of mountainous area where there's a few kutis. And then there's a place where they call the inner forest, which is where a lot of the wildlife is, where you get all sorts of wild animals roaming around there, a thick jungle. And normally, when the Wat Nanachat monks go out there, it might be up to 20 monks who go out there for the hot season. And everybody lives on these bamboo platforms where it's split bamboo slats, to make a bed. It's about 8 feet long and raised up off the ground. And then there's a couple of bamboo poles coming up with a bamboo pole overhead to hang your glot. It's like an umbrella mosquito net from, and one lives on that bamboo platform for 2 or 3 months, the hot season, in the middle of the jungle. And all of these different campsites will have a walking meditation path, and the area is quite big, so a lot of these sites are separate from each other, and one gets solitude. But there's also a meeting hall, a sala, in this inner forest area, and there's a separate sala on the outer mountainous area. So this, we call it the inner forest sala. So I decided to go to the inner forest with one other monk, so it was just the two of us in the inner forest for about 2 or 3 weeks before the group showed up. And so a lot of the sites weren't really cleared yet, and there was a Burmese worker who was currently building a lot of these bamboo platforms. There was a couple that were ready, so we had set up on the bamboo platforms that were ready. And I was really, it was a really new experience, but I was also very kind of excited to be practicing in that way. And so each evening I made a point of, because it was still the cold, end of the cold season, there was no mosquitoes out yet really, so I was sitting not in the net, but I would go to this inner forest sala and sit in front of the Buddha image each evening, do a bit of chanting and sit by myself there for an hour or two. And it's kind of an open area about the size of the cloister area here, and sitting on at this sala one evening, and I just heard this kind of like poop, 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 poop. And I kind of like turned my eyes, and there's just a leopard just padding by. It didn't even notice me. It didn't even know I was there. And it's kind of like, okay, well, back to the breath. Just I'm not going to get up. And I mean, there's nothing to do. It's just, it's a leopard. What do you do? So, but, you know, and it's like not feeling any fear though. Just, it was just like a feeling of a blessing of meditating outside. That's the kind of things you can experience. Or remember walking meditation. Really get up. I'm not a very, very much a late night person, but more a morning person. So I get up at 2 or 3 in the morning and do some walking meditation. I remember doing walking meditation very early one morning, and the jungle can get very quiet at those hours in the morning. And I remember doing walking meditation. It's just had some candles going on the path, and then it's just pitch black all around the walking meditation path. And doing walking meditation is very quiet, and suddenly I hear this like ksh, ksh, ksh. The forest, I thought, oh no, something really big is walking towards me. And really, really, really scared, and just thought, okay, well, all I can do is just keep walking. And so, and then it would stop this like in the leaves like this, and it would stop, and it's maybe like 20 feet away, and then it was like it's maybe 10 or 15 feet away, and my hair is standing on end, and oh no, like this is what's going to happen. Is something just going to jump out and eat me? Or and then it, sure enough, this whatever it is it's coming right towards the walking meditation path, and it's going to come onto the path. And so I stop at the end, and I'm thinking, okay, it's coming to the other end of the path now. And this little tiny mouse jumps. It was a mouse, and it was jumping. This little tiny mouse jumps out onto the end of the path, and then runs down the path and jumps off to the other side. in the mind, I was thinking this giant tiger, like this vicious thing, or maybe a bear. And then this one, not too long after that, also one night was sitting under the mosquito net, and it was like meditation was going well, so I was staying up a bit later than I normally would. I think it was about 11 p.m. And I was getting ready to go to sleep, and so I thought, okay, well, I have to go to the pit toilet and, you know, relieve myself before I had to go go pass water before going to sleep. And right as I was going to get out of the mosquito net, again, the forest was very quiet, and right as I was going to get out of the mosquito net, then I suddenly hear this giant crash, maybe like 50 feet away in the forest. And this animal just starts screaming. I don't know if it was a deer or a small wild boar or whatever, but I heard this, like, it was a loud crash and then this screaming, and something was just screaming over and over, and then a loud crunching noise, and the screaming stopped after that loud crunching noise happened. And then after the loud crunching noise, just like something very big leaping, very, you know, And then nothing. And so I didn't see what it was, but I actually didn't go out of my net that night. So I just, couldn't make myself go out of the net. So we can't really get, I mean, there are mountain lions here, but you're probably not going to have that kind of experience here, but still. Yeah, you can go, yeah, try walking around the loop trail at night, or go and sit outside at night and see what happens, see what kind of fears come up. It can be a good experience. I remember after a while just getting numb to it. Just like any sound that happened then, it was like, instead of fear, it was just like, okay, well, that's just normal. But I think I bring this up because it's like we listen to teachings and study a lot of books, and it's like, well, this is what the Buddha's pointing towards is getting out and doing the practice, experiencing things. And, you know, we're keeping precepts and we're eating one meal a day and doing quite a bit of meditation, and there's inevitable difficulties that are going to arise, but those difficulties are good as well, because there can be a sense of camaraderie, there can be a sense of shared difficulties. Yeah, it's quite good, I think, that if there is difficulties, we learn from that. Everybody's in it together. If you're not in the small percentile of those who are floating in jhanic bliss on a regular basis, then yeah, there's we're having to learn, we're having to suffer, learning from the suffering. There's this quote from Ajahn Chah that I like to contemplate. He said, we don't practice for the sake of heaven. We don't practice for the sake of heaven. We practice to end suffering. Those are two very different things. Or like Ruth Dennison, this lovely little anecdote. Lungpor Pasano going to visit Ruth Dennison recently, and she's you know, she's very old, might die soon. She's really one of the main forerunners of the bringing the Dhamma to the West, Dhamma in America, bringing what we call the Satchatam, the Satcha Dhamma, the true practice, the Dhamma leading to liberation. And she's just making this point, you know, don't limit yourselves. You know, it's not about happiness. Dhamma practice is not about happiness. It's not about being happy. It's more than that. It's transcendence, it's liberation, which could be, you know, we can think of that as the highest happiness. And the Buddha did say it is the highest happiness. Nibbanang paramang sukhang. Nibbana is the highest happiness. But it's not happiness as we normally think of it. It's not the happiness where we're going about, you know, smiling all the time. It's not that. It's very, very powerful. It's different. It's not like the happiness that comes from sensual pleasures. Because that's also a type of happiness, you know, gratification from, you know, eating good food or seeing a good movie or reading a good novel. I mean, that's the happiness that comes from sexual pleasures. That's gratification. But there's also danger. The danger in that is it doesn't last. It's so utterly fleeting. The escape, you know, complete detachment from it, complete relinquishment from that desire and craving for sensual pleasures. So that's the happiness we're seeking. That's what we focus on. That's what we practice for. It's not to say, you know, that getting a charge from having a good meal is bad or evil or wrong. It's okay to enjoy the meal. It's okay to enjoy life, even. Yeah. It's like, I love this Longpo Pasano and the teaching. Yesterday morning, I think it was in the questions at the end of the teaching, he made this comment that, you know, whenever you were around Ajahn Chah, it's like you could have an ideal of what an arhat is supposed to be, and he would always make a point of acting differently than that. Thinking even hearing stories about Lungpur Liam, like when he was more junior, when he was 12, 13, 14, 15, Vasas, a lot of people were very critical of him. It wasn't like now where he's Lungpa and is almost universally accepted by everybody. A lot of people were very critical. Ah, he just works all the time. He's restless, you know. People would say that about Ajahn Liam. He's restless. He's just seeking distraction. It's hard to think people would say that kind of stuff about him now, but yeah, people would say that about him. Even people would say he's, you know, he can't have any special attainments. He can't, you know, even somebody even said he's corrupt or something. Ajahn Kevali telling me that people would say he's, you know, his mind is just corrupt. And even Lungpor Biak had this anecdote. He said it. He would sit behind Ajahn Liam in the meditation, and they were both maybe, Ajahn Liam was maybe 10 Vasa at that time, and Ajahn Biak would have been 5 or 7 or something. And he said he didn't have any faith in Ajahn Liam at all. He said, who is this guy, you know, thinking like, And then, but then eventually he realized, he started noticing things. He started about Ajahn Liam. After a while, he had just complete faith in him. Ajahn Biak said, as his own practice developed, he was able to see that, oh yeah, he had complete faith in Ajahn Liam, and he could see actually he was the one to take as an example. But not many people could see that. Not many people could see that early on. He works all the time. He's seeking distraction. He's restless. Or in the meditation, he's nodding. You know, he's just got hindrances. He doesn't know how to meditate. So I really like that. I've heard stories about Lungpo Cha, these Thai disciples, complete faith in Lungpo Cha, and yet he would still do stuff which they wouldn't be really sure about. And you can almost, there's this good story too about Ajahn Sumedho, because Ajahn Cha would publicly tell people, you know, if you find fault with me, let me know, you know, don't be Grangjai, don't be afraid of me because I'm the big Ajahn, you know, don't be afraid to tell me if you find fault with me. Of course, the Thai monks are terrified. They would never, ever do that. But the Farangs weren't afraid to. So Ajahn Sumedho has this lovely, he said he decided, okay, well, I found a fault with Ajahn Cha, so I'm going to go tell him about it. So he went to Ajahn Cha, and I don't know what the fault was, but it was something, I think it was like not really a Vinaya thing, but more like a personality type flaw or something. And so he went to tell Ajahn Cha about it, and Ajahn Cha kind of chuckled and said, it's good that I'm not perfect, because if I was perfect, then all of my disciples might try to look for the Buddha outside of themselves. It's like, oh, that's good. If I was the ideal monk, if I met all of your ideals, you might try to look for the Buddha outside of yourself. So the Buddha's not outside. We look for the Buddha inside. I'm sure even, you know, even here, if, you know, Ajahn Pasano, he gets projected onto, you know, people probably have all sorts of ideas about him as well. But just, I think it's coming back to like not letting the mind get all tied up in knots. It doesn't really matter. It's, unless we have abhinyas, which is rare, to have real abhinyas, you know, psychic powers, unless we can really see other people's minds, we don't know. So let us suspend our judgments. Let's not get the mind all tied up in knots with just, you know, our likes and dislikes. Likes and dislikes tend to get the mind all tied up in knots. Just, you know, might be in the meditation, the mind is just droning on and on and on and on and on and on. I like this person, I like that, and this person, this monk's like that. This one's my favorite. I don't like that one. This one's probably this way, this one's that. And then suddenly the mind stops and, oh wow, it's actually quiet outside. There's no sound. Just noticing how quiet it is. And the mind goes quiet. So what's that like when the mind goes quiet? then the mind might jump in and start figuring it out. Oh, what is that? What was that? And coming back to the breath, mind goes quiet again. Okay, it's quiet, so maybe I'll get into First Jhana soon. Oh. And there's the mind trying to figure it out again, trying to thinking. Patience, yeah. Kanti paramang tapo titika. Is the patience is the ultimate incinerator of the defilements. Patience. It's like the Chinese saying that the patient person is always happy. Patient person is always content. When we practice with patience, there's a certain, you know, even if we don't, you know, like a lot of obstructions, hindrances, if one is patient, there's a certain contentment that comes along with that, because faith and inspiration is very fleeting and it goes up and down. Being on retreat for almost a month, it's possible that things start to look kind of bleak. You know, what's the point of it all? It's not that special being in a monastery. It's just ordinary. There was a guy who visited here years ago who he had been a monk for a few years with Lungpor Panyananda in Thailand, highly respected, very famous Ajahn, contemporary of Ajahn Buddhadasa, good friend of the Wat Nanachat community, one of our Krupa Ajahns. So this guy who visited here is a Westerner. He'd been a monk for a few years with Lungpor Panyananda and somehow had become disaffected with just hierarchy and a lot of the forms that are followed in the monastery. So he disrobed. But he came here and visited several years ago and just walking around. And I remember talking to him for a little bit, and he was asking me, like, what do you think? Are you gonna be a monk for the rest of your life? And I was saying, well, I don't know. I'm just a young monk. I don't think about it that much. But he's like, well, just remember, monastic life is just monastic life. And I thought, that sounds really bleak and depressing. Meaningless. I don't quite see it that way. It is just a form, but it's very helpful. Yeah. The hierarchy is how the Sangha is organized. When the Sangha was first starting to grow, and there's monasteries were starting to be established, and Antapindika would have already offered the Jetta's Grove, and there's Veluvana, the Bamboo Grove, and the Squirrel's Sanctuary. These different monasteries were cropping up. The Sangha was living together, so the Sangha had to be organized. There was no real hierarchy, and kind of discussion, arguments broke out. Well, how should we organize ourselves? And so some monks said, well, we should go by whoever has the most barami. So whoever has the most barami should go first in the food line. And well, how do you measure that? How do you measure who has the most barami? The most barami, like I have the most bar meat. I'll go first in the food line. He has the most disciples. He must have the most bar meat. Well, that's really difficult to measure. So some monks said, whoever has the most bar meat should go first. And some monks said, whoever is the oldest. So like those who have ordained later in life but are junior, they should go before those who are senior but who ordained when they were younger. So those who are the oldest. And then some said, those who have the noble attainments should go first. And so it's like, well, how do you measure that? Like some newly ordained monks, like, well, I'm a Sotapanna and all you guys are just clowns. So it's like, I'll go first. So it's like, how do you measure that? The arhants should go first, the anagamis afterwards, sakadagamis after that, the sotapannas, then those who have the fourth jhana, then those who have the third jhana, then those who have the second jhana, those who have the first jhana. So the Buddha comes in and, okay, well, I think it should just be by whoever ordained first. We'll just go by that. It's easy, it's simple, it's practical. So that's how the Sangha got organized. We don't have to really think about it. If one is newly ordained and has achieved arhantship, that's great. They can delight in being able to be quiet for 5 or 10 years before they're in the teaching seat. they can delight in that quietude, not having to have many responsibilities. So it's a blessing, I think, being in the monastery. It's like the Buddha Dhamma Sangha is alive and well. So if things start to get a bit bleak, the mind is getting a bit, tending a bit off the middle way, getting a bit critical of oneself, critical of others. Come back to that. Or like the body contemplation is starting to be like, oh God, intestines, or it's like it's getting a bit kind of towards the aversive side. Coming back to Buddha Nusati. It's like we do it in the chanting all the time, chanting the virtues of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, but really coming back to that as a reflection. Something which reflecting on these things are alive. So the Buddha, we have, it's almost as if the Buddha is present. We have the suttas, we have the teachings, we have this incredible wealth of wisdom and blessings present. We're willing to hear, we are able to hear the Dhamma at will. Teachings which lead to liberation. We're able to hear and read those teachings at will. It's a rare in the world. We're living in a time where we're not, there's no draft. We're not in a time of war. Not that long ago, if you were between, whatever, 18 and 25 or something, you could be drafted into Vietnam, or it's a time of peace. And the Dhamma, we're able to reflect on the Dhamma apparent here and now. We're able to meditate and reflect on the way things are. And the Sangha, that's us, that's everybody here. The Sangha is here. And the Buddha, more though, he talked about, he didn't say the Sangha was, in the chanting we don't say like, these are the Blessed One's disciples, people wearing robes. You know, we don't say that. This is the Sangha of the heart, the Buddha is talking about. You know, the Sangha of the heart is the people on the path, you know, on the path, following the Noble Eightfold Path. The four pairs, the eight types of noble beings, that the technical list, you can list it out, is in the suttas, you know. Path, you're on the path to stream entry, you've reached the fruit of stream entry, path to Sakadagami, fruit of Sakadagami, path of non-returner, fruit of non-returner, path to arhantship, fruit of arhantship, that's the four pairs, the eight types of noble beings. In a more practical way, though, like, you know, for myself, I just like to think of it as like path, you know, being on the path. Not, you know, it's like if there's no attainments, but not really thinking in terms of noble attainments, but just, yeah, the practice is here. We have this ability to practice now. That makes us the Sangha, the fact that we're making an effort. That makes us the Sangha. You know, path to stream entry, even if it takes a whole lifetime. We might think, oh well, you know, that's not quite technically what the suttas say. I'm going to go across. That's not the Abhidhamma. It says, you know, path and fruit is both instantaneous, happening instantaneous. But is that really helpful? Is that helpful? It's kind of nice to see it's another point I kind of wanted to bring up tonight was... so we're all well aware. The Venerable Titapo has left the robes, disrobed, and I think on a certain level, it's the way he's left is very, very good, and still very clear that he'll remain in the circle, the monastic circle, at least for a little while, remain a friend to many people here. Talking with Lumbor Pasano the other day, and I think, yeah, it's kind of a maturing of the Sangha in the West. And the fact that we're not putting a stigma on when people leave the robes, it's quite important for the maturity and long-term benefit of the Sangha in the West. It's a bit more like Thailand. It feels a bit more like Thailand, like your people might ordain and then leave, but then they stay close. But if we put a stigma on it, then it's like, well, you're in or you're out. You know, it's like, okay, well, you get out of here. You know, we can't be like that because that's just not sustainable. It's like there was a monk who was just a little bit senior to Ajahn Sumedho. When Ajahn Sumedho first ordained, there was this monk at Wat Bapong who was like really, really strict with the Khor Wat and really like quite fierce. And Ajahn Sumedho was really inspired by him. And he taught Ajahn Sumedho a lot about the Khor Wat, the rules and protocols of training. And this monk was also ascetic, taking on the Dutanga practices, and also was like really hard on others who didn't keep the Khor Wat. You know, ordain till the death. What are you doing? This is the Khor Wat. You know, really, really quite strict, quite fierce. And after not very long, that monk ended up disrobing and became the village drunk. And Ajahn Sumedho was, you know, he, if I remember the story correctly, it's like he's really like kind of aghast at what happened to this monk. And Ajahn Chah just said, well, you should always have gratitude for him. He taught you the Korwat. He taught you the training. You should always have gratitude for him. Always say hi to him when you see him in the village. Always be nice to him. It's like, I definitely don't think that's going to happen to Titapo, you know. I don't. I think he's headed for better things than being a village drunk, for sure. And he was in the robes, I believe, longer than that. And he certainly wasn't going and hitting people over the head with the Korwat Patipat. I think he's very, very led his monk's life in a very good, skillful way. And so I was kind of hoping he was going to be here this morning so I could say Anumodana for his monk's life and 10 years of pretty selfless service to the Sangha. I mean, he designed our website, so there's right there is a stream of merit which isn't going to end anytime soon. Him and Dushan and the website, that's what you call Mahadana. I think kind of on that point too, as far as like selfless service, another point that I think is good to remember during a retreat time, and we're, you know, practicing and trying to understand and figure out a lot of these teachings and what mindfulness means, how to be mindful, how to practice the Satipatthana, is just not thinking about oneself too much, not focusing on oneself too much, or one's own practice. I definitely found this like the first week of the retreat. I seem to find it whenever I get on a retreat, feeling depressed, the beginning of a retreat, and it's just so true. Like Ajahn Sumedho saying, whenever I think about myself, I get depressed. And because I have that same tendency, like self-criticism, and, you know, oh, you did this in the past, and this or that in the past, and it's just kind of, so that was bad karma, kind of getting down on oneself. But then again, it's just like the mind just getting all tied up in knots, just allowing it to just unwind, using the retreat time to unwind, just rather than thinking of it as destroying or beating down one's old habits, thinking of it as treating oneself to the meditation, treating oneself to the retreat, allowing oneself to unwind, untying the knots and relaxing into the retreat, relaxing into the Korwat Patipat. That's so important because it's not sustainable if we take it on in a really tense, almost aggressive way. That's just not sustainable. Patience, yeah. Patience and just wearing away. Things get difficult, and just telling oneself, just be patient. That's mindfulness too, just recollecting patience, recollecting to be patient. Not just gritting one's teeth and burying it till it ends, but just learning how to be with whatever arises, learning how to be with any experience. The meditation doesn't go deep, it's okay. The point isn't to experience a certain thing during the meditation, although we do want the mind to calm down and get peaceful, but it's creating a space where the mind can naturally settle. We can't make the mind settle or ripen faster than it's going to. It has to go at its own pace. Another Ajahn Chah quote is, we don't have to go everywhere looking for peace. When the mind is ripe, peace will come looking for you. When you've put the causes and conditions in place, you won't be able to stop peace and contentment from arising. You might even think, you know, no, I'm, you know, I, even if you think, I want to suffer more, I want to be miserable, you've already put the causes and conditions for peace and contentment in place. So, yeah, happiness. There's going to be happiness, contentment arising. You'll know for yourself. I'll leave it there for this evening.